You're listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience, a podcast dedicated to helping executives train their sales and marketing teams to optimize growth. Whether you're looking for techniques and strategies or tools and resources, you've come to the right place. Let's accelerate your growth in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everyone, to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. I'm Carlos Noche, and unfortunately, my partner Lisa Snare is off working with another great client today, so you're stuck with me. Today, we're talking about how the buyer-seller dynamics are changing, which is causing some friction in the sales process. For example, buyers today are much more predisposed to a specific solution before they ever engage with a seller. And to help us with that, we got our very own Greg Brown, one of our very own value selling associates who brings 20 plus years of experience in tech sales and leadership, building high performance teams for some of the industry's top tech firms. Hey, Greg, how are you today?
Hey, good morning, Carlos. How are you?
Good. Greg, you know, we always start out with the same question. What is something that you're passionate about that those that primarily only know you through work might be surprised to know about you?
Well, you know, I don't know if it'd be so much of a surprise, but what I'm passionate about, I've recently really started leaning into fly fishing. It's something I did as a kid in the lakes and rivers and stuff like that. And now I, living here in San Francisco, I'm actually close to what a lot of locals would call one of the best estuaries in the world. And so I've really started kind of leaning in heavily to doing that.
I live in the trout capital of Georgia. I'm literally on the water. I mean, there's guided tours in the neighborhood before mine. So you're going to have to come down to Georgia sometime.
I would love to do that. The thing I find so interesting about doing it here in San Francisco is you do it off of the shore. So I can walk up and down the shore in shorts and t-shirt, depending upon the weather. And I can also correlate it very closely. A lot of analogies with fishing to selling, which may be time for another podcast another day. But I would suffice it to say, if you don't love just being out there casting and trying, then you're not going to succeed at fishing. And same thing goes for sales. You've got to love the process. You've got to love the doing. You've got to love the challenge in order to succeed. So there's a lot of things that kind of come together.
Last little comment. I enjoy fly fishing because when you're trying to cast that perfect setup, you're not thinking about work. So I really find it relaxing. And then the number two thing I really like about it is I'm always working. So I'm always inviting clients to come down and go fishing because I need an excuse to leave this office.
Put me on that list. And I also say that I read an article not long ago that said they call it blue therapy. Just being out there in the water, around the water, it's therapeutic. And that's something that I can definitely appreciate.
Tell us a little bit about your professional background. You've had a great career. Give us some of the highlights.
I always like to start that discussion with right out of college, I had the privilege of working for Xerox Corporation and widely, you know, referred to and considered to be one of the top sales training organizations in the world. I would have to agree with that. I was on a 6-week offsite training program that taught the fundamentals of spin selling. So I'd like to say that that's kind of embedded in my DNA. It's like kind of like learning a golf swing from a teaching pro or maybe your father who was a great golfer. And it's like part of your habits. It's kind of baked into what you do. So I had the privilege of doing that. Since then, I've been fortunate enough to be a part of a lot of early stage tech companies, emerging companies that have disruptive technologies. Probably the most noteworthy one was Salesforce.com. I was fortunate to join that company back in the early 2000s, employee number 230 something. So I watched that company go from selling a product that was really just focused on sort of the SMB space, up-leveling it into enterprise space. Mark Benioff called it the great experiment back in the day. And had a great run there, a lot of success, a lot of learnings and so forth. So been fortunate to be a part of a number of companies like that.
All right. So before the podcast, we were talking about some Gartner study and some stats. Can you share with our audience? Because I think it really helps set up our topic for today.
So I think the primary thing that I've seen is this evolution of the buyer-seller journey, and that has been changing. It's been changing for the entire course of my career, but I think that change has been accelerating in the past, say, 5 years or so. And that has created some real friction and some challenges for sales organizations to keep up with this changing dynamic. And so I started reaching out to some of the folks in my network and said, hey, I'm going to be doing a podcast on this subject. Can you weigh in on that? What are you seeing And I got a huge amount of responses to this, Carlos. Like people were saying, yes, that's absolutely a dynamic that we've recognized and certainly interested in hearing more about what you've experienced and how you're approaching it.
What was that Gartner study about that we talked about?
So I like the work that Gartner does. I feel like they do have a pulse on the B2B buying dynamic. And they've had one study that's been going on, I think, for like the past 4 years. And one of them is, it talks about that 75% of the B2B buyers would prefer a rep-free experience. You know, meaning, you know, that they would like to do this without a lot of engagement from the seller. And the reason they cite is that the seller brings little, if any, true additional value to the table. In other words, what they're able to get online through the vast amounts of information, including platforms and services like G2, you know, have an open forum for people to rate applications online. There's a lot of information available. So they're doing a lot of that work on the front end before they ever even touch a salesperson's sort of engagement. And one of the things I'll add to that is back in the day, in my early sales training day or early sales days, I was fortunate to work for a brilliant sales strategist who ended up founding this awesome company, awesome sales training company. And he would tell us that at that time, 30% of buyers, 30% predisposed to a solution. And the reason they're predisposed is because they work in a cohort of people in their network. If they're a CFO or a CRO, they're talking to people daily about like, what are their challenges? How are they solving for them? And there's available information. Now, this predates the vast amount of information that's available on the internet. Gartner suggests actually that they're more like 60 to 70% predisposed. And whether you buy into those statistics or not, is not kind of not necessarily the point. I think the point is really, is that a phenomena that's happening? And I would, without a doubt, agree that it is. Whether it's gone from 30 to 50 or 30 to 70, who knows? I don't think you can put a stake in the ground on that, but it's an absolute phenomena that's taking place and going to continue to.
Does that mean like programs like value selling are dead in the future?
No, I think it means that they're more important than ever. And that is because when you do have the opportunity, when the seller does have the opportunity to be in front of the customer, you have to bring your A game to the table, right? The bad news for this is that, you know, reps are being marginalized to a certain extent. People are bringing them in later in that evaluation process. And so if that's affecting their ability to succeed. But the flip side of that, the good news is that the reps that figure this out are going to have a competitive advantage over the reps that struggle. And that competitive advantage is in large part going to be based on the building of the trust that comes with being prepared and being organized and having a process that fits that new buyer-seller journey.
As you can imagine, I got a strong view on this, but let's dissect it a little bit more first. What might be some of the factors that are contributing to this?
That's exactly right. That's the new buying model. And we're all buying that way, whether we're buying stuff recently and you shop online and people are shopping for B2B technologies. But at some point, in most cases, they have to engage with the seller. And so the thing I think is super important is that seller needs to understand that they already have like a potential credibility issue that they need to overcome, which means the buyer may not be thinking of them in terms of bringing true value to this conversation. When they show up to this, they need to overcome that predisposition or that perception of what the seller is really there to do. What I hear a lot of is that the buyer just wants to get into feature validation and pricing discussions, right? And the seller needs to be prepared for that may be, in fact, the way this conversation is going to go, but would immediately have a plan to shift it to a more of an outcome-based, value realization-based discussion. And what we find is that the people that are really qualified and do that, you know, have a high degree of proficiency in this area, are easily able to shift that conversation discussion. Because at the end of the day, the buyer is most concerned about less about features and more about, will this project be a success? And that's where you want the seller to take the conversation. What are the end outcomes that you're trying to achieve? It's that whole, why do anything? Why now? Why us? Put into a blueprint or a framework to allow the seller to be prepared to have these conversations and to expect certain challenges attached to these conversations and to be able to move this forward into a more of a business value, financial outcome and impact level conversation.
So in your opinion, given this buyer-seller dynamic in the market, what are some ways that sellers can actually be successful in that dynamic?
I boil it down to like three things, okay? So it needs the skill set, the actual value selling skill set. That is a skill. You can't just show up and wing it anymore. It never worked to begin with that well, but it works less so now. They need a tool set, this framework or this sort of blueprint, or how do I conduct these kinds of conversations? And then the discipline actually to do it consistently. So those are the three things that I would certainly put a stake in the ground on.
I hear this from customers. Sometimes it's a pushback from reps as we're doing a workshop. Oh, Carlos, you know, all we're doing is getting people to go, hey, yeah, I did my research. Like you said, validate it, does what I think it does, and show me how much. I go, well, if you're lucky enough to be able to send out quotes and collect orders and you're successful, phenomenal. That's awesome. I would automate the demo and just sit back and watch the orders come in. If you're not lucky enough to be in that world, then real salespeople need to show up. And when I say show up, you know, I remind the folks, it's like, I don't disagree that there's more information out there than ever, right? Same thing that Gartner study talked about. And that means calling you, the seller, late into a sales cycle. What that also means is you have to do your homework in shorter amounts of time. You're not going to have 5, 10 discovery meetings across the board. You got to figure out a way, how do you get access to information about this company, their business, their industry, right? What's going on in their world? What outcomes are their executives saying they want to see? But when you do meet with them, you can ask better, intelligent questions. You can prove that, yeah, we have a great product, but it might not be the right product for you. What are your business situations that you're in? Are you seeing some of the same challenges that others in your marketplace are seeing? And in a way, challenge your thinking a little bit to get the opportunity to really do the discovery that we all think we need. What do you think of that?
You touched on a couple of really important things. You know, people buy from people that they trust. And trust is a difficult thing to just manifest quickly. A couple of the key components of this, and I started studying it much more deeply. You know, as a hiring manager in the, you know, the tech sales world, oftentimes I would ask or a candidate, a potential seller, you know, what makes you better? What makes you exceptional? What makes you awesome? You know, tell me what your, you know, what your real strength is. And it's interesting, 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 of the cases, they came out with the same answer. And it was, you know, I guess I just build great relationships with my customer. And I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, that kind of is universal, right? And then I would follow up and ask the question, well, tell me what it is you do. How do you do it? And the same 8 out of 10 people that, you know, said they did, they didn't have an answer. They didn't have a process for doing that. Okay. They just showed up. It was almost as if to say, hey, I just show up and I'm just me and I build these great relationships, right? Well, what about the people that didn't buy from you? Okay. Does that mean you didn't have a great relationship? And how do you scale that skill set to a point where it can be repeatable? Where's your plan to do that? Almost no one. I remember one case, I had a guy that just crushed the answer. I was like, wow, like this guy's on an A game going. It's interesting. Most people know that it's important and very important. And yet most people don't have a plan to do it. So building trust is essential. And I would say that that's a much longer conversation, but let me kind of summarize it as best I can. First, it's that old adage, show me you know me. Don't show up with, you know, your hands in your pockets as if you've done no work and you're just there to kind of, you know, start from scratch. You better bring something to the table in terms of, I understand, here's my understanding of what's going on. But most importantly, it's about understanding, having that framework to drive a dialogue to get to the bottom line, which is, why are you doing this? What's the potential business outcome impact, financial impact? How does it affect other people in the organization? And thus driving the priority of a decision like this. And then what does success look like for you? When you can manage that conversation and surface those discussion points, you're starting to build trust. And it really helps if you've got an authentic interest in helping this customer. I think that's a baseline requirement. But then people recognize that. People actually recognize if you're really in this to close the deal or are you in this to help us. So I'll just pause on that for a second. I do have a follow-up point that I think is really interesting as it relates to that whole trust building equation.
I agree with you. What's interesting about the way you stated this, you stated, hey, it's about building trust. You didn't say it's about being liked. And again, I have a lot of pet peeves. People that know me know I got a million of them. One of them is when people say, well, it's about being, you need to be liked. I think that's complete and utter BS. You need to be respected and trusted. That is a different thing. I like a lot of people. I'm not giving them $1 million check for some technology or a project. So finish up your point on the trust, because I think you're on something there.
So I started buying some like psychology studies on it. I bought this awesome book and I've read it a couple of times called The Trusted Advisor. I put my own formula together, like a sort of a basic formula that I'll share with you. And then as I was reading through this book, Trusted Advisor, it actually had a very similar formula, but added one dimension to it, which changed my thinking altogether. So my formula was this: rapport times credibility times value equals trust. And let me break those down. I actually wrote something. It's on my LinkedIn profile on this topic. Rapport is just that likability factor. To your point, I agree. Like, there's a lot of people I like. I go out and hang out with, have a beer with, but I wouldn't let them manage my finances because I wouldn't trust them to do so, right? But I'd hang out with them because I like them. They're fun people. So rapport is that baseline. Credibility is, do you know what you're talking about? Do you have deep expertise? Value is, will you convert that credibility, your expertise, into something that matters to me, that's meaningful and impactful to me? And if you have that, you're on the path to building trust. Some people think rapport equals trust. It does not. It's a component of it, right? So then I started reading this book and they added one other dimension to this. And they said, you add those three things. They had their own definitions, but it was largely kind of aligned with my stuff. And they said, divide that by me orientation. And the me orientation means, does the buyer believe that you are primarily interested in your own success and your own business outcomes, meaning closing that deal, versus your business outcomes, which means being successful, seeing value, and having a successful outcome. So they divided what I was talking about, which is rapport, credibility, and value, and you divide that by the me orientation factor. If you got a high me orientation factor, which people will pick up on, that diminishes the trust factor.
I like that. That's really good. I'm stealing that and I'm leaving that on the record.
Well, I got this book here. I've read this several times. This is so great. A Trusted Advisor. It is so great. Like, and again, it boils down to this common theme, which is I refer to as the knowing doing gap. We can all look at this book and go, oh yeah, I know. This is not telling me anything I don't already know. You know, the question is, okay, but what are you doing? How are you doing it? Do you have a plan? And this really helped, in my mind, kind of codify how to take it from a conceptual to an, you know, practical plan. I use it all the time.
Let's go back to doing it. And what I mean by that is this. I mean, I'm sure we got some listeners that go, yeah, yeah, but you don't get it. I mean, the customers call me up. They say, hey, you know, we need one of your widgets or whatever solution you're providing Tuesday. Do you want to come in and do this or not? In fact, I just had someone push back on me on a workshop I did, and they go, well, Carlos, you don't understand. In my market, they were in an international market. Culturally, people don't value salespeople. There's a mindset like, hey, your job is to provide me a demo. Your job is to provide me pricing. And I understood that, but I also showed them, speaking of studies, there's a Forrester study, and it talks about these executive decision makers and what they're really looking for. And the first thing on the study, it says 88% of them, 88, are looking for a conversation, not a presentation. And I think that right off the bat is, in my opinion, and I'd love to get your view, is one of the problems. You said earlier, we need to have the discipline. We need to have the discipline to push back a little bit, to say, I would love to show you the product. Can I at least ask a few questions to make sure I don't waste your time and mine? And those questions need to be about a conversation about, and you know, thinking back to your formula about them, their business, their industry, their expectations, right? And I think that's critical because I think most of us just fall, either we get lazy or we fall into this trap of, oh, all right, they want to see the product, warm up the demo, and we fall, you know, we immediately turn those executive buyers off. What are some of your thoughts? And if this is the world that we're facing, what do I need to have discipline on to be able to be more effective?
So let me start by saying this is a phenomenon, but for those people who really figure this out, it opens a whole world of opportunity for them to differentiate themselves, build trust. Ironically, the customer wants this, but they've been conditioned, unfortunately, that most sellers will bow to their demands. There's a time to say no, and there's mostly a time to guide and shepherd people through the process, but that requires a plan. And I'll quote not one of the world's great philosophers, but he did come up with a great quote. Mike Tyson, you know the Mike Tyson quote? Everybody has a plan to get punched in the nose, right? So you need going in to have this plan, but also anticipate where customer might be wanting to pull you into, pull you down into. And that's, let's talk about features. Let's talk about pricing. I need to see a demo. You have to be ready for that. And you have to have the skill set and the tool set to execute when that happens, because it's going to happen most likely.
I was just talking about that this week, and I was like, hey, well, Carlos, what if they really push for that? I go, fine. You got to realize where you're at in that sales cycle. Because, you know, one of the things we talked about is, well, Carlos, they're, you know, some of my clients have a very strict procurement process. They release an RFP. There's no talking to the vendor. I don't have any chance to ask these questions. And I go, oh my God, I've heard this for years. I go, what do you do? He goes, well, we respond to the RFP. And what are the percentage of times you win? Very, very little. I go, for the ones that you did win, what changed? What was the difference? Were you the cheapest? No. Did you answer the best? I don't think so. What do you think made the difference? In those situations, I found a way to get involved with the client before the RFP. I found a way to influence them and have a dialogue. And in doing so, the RFP was more aligned, predisposed, if you will, to their perspectives or their capabilities and their differentiators. So that was like, hey, other advice to or tactics to help our sellers today navigate through these dynamics.
Well, like I've said, I think if you begin with the end in mind, and I love that comment, that sort of idiom that's been around for a while, and help the customer begin with the end in mind, which is what is it you're trying to get out of this? What's the end goal, the end solution? And understand that the buyer's perspective is and should be very sort of focused on their own frame of reference and their own business challenges and business objectives that they're trying to accomplish, right? People have problems. Companies don't have problems. So when you're in front of someone, you're solving for that person's problems. But the best sellers are able to attach the issues that that person is, that the persona that you're in front of, to other greater issues, bigger, more impactful, more strategic, imperative-like topics, and attach it to the greater good of the organization. And when you're able to do that, you're able to, and typically, raise the bar on the value that you're going to be providing, and also raise your potential for access to other people, you know, within the buying community, within that organization. And what I hear repeatedly is that one of the top challenges that people have is access to power. Thematically, that is one of the top, if not the top, most oftentimes referenced challenge that most sellers have. So the way to gain access is to attach what the persona you're speaking with, how that person is serving the greater good of a higher level set of priorities. That's a bit of an advanced selling skill, honestly. But, you know, the best sellers are figuring out, you know, how to do that. And having said that, they need, again, the skills, the tools, and the discipline in order to do that. Coming in and winging it most of the time is just not going to work out well for you if you're trying to raise that conversation.
There was a sales kickoff that I did, and I was partnered up with his former CIO. And of course, everybody was there to listen to him, not me. But he said something really profound. I never forgot about it. And it aligns right to our value selling framework, Greg. And that says, look, if you're going to go through the gauntlet to get on my schedule and come talk to me, tell me how you can help me with my problems at my level. If you're going to come spew about how great your technology is, I'm just going to push you down to someone else on my team to go evaluate it, because that's not what I do. If you're going to come talk to me about these lower level issues and tell me how you can help with it, I go, great, not my issue. It's their issue. Go talk to them. So if you can do the research, prepare yourself to have a conversation at my level to talk about my business, the industry challenges at my level, I'll give you the time of day. And if you can ping one and tell me that you can address it, I'll help you fill in the blanks and navigate the organization. I'm there for you. But you got to immediately show me how, you know, this conversation is going to be valuable for me. So I thought that was a really big lesson for me in talking to higher levels of power and how we have to evolve our dialogue, our questions. And you said it earlier, we got to be prepared.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's two primary ways you get to power. One is you start there, start high, right? That's always the preferred method, needless to say. And to your point, people will meet with you, provided you're bringing value to that conversation. The next best is you're working at a middle or senior middle level of the organization, and you turn that person into your champion, and they introduce you to power. That's equally as effective, in many cases more so, because you're getting that kind of sponsorship. Having said that, easier said than done. We all know that that's a great method, okay? In fact, having personally been through like 10 different sales methodologies over my career as a tech seller, every one of those sales methodologies says the same thing, you know, get to the decision maker, understand the buying criteria, right? What they're a little shallow on, okay, is not the what to do, it's the how to do it. The skills, the tools, the preparation, you know, and the practice that goes with refining that, because it is a high level selling skill that when you master it, and there's never mastery, you know, but when you become highly proficient in it, it's probably one of the best payoffs you can possibly have as a seller, is to build the skill set of driving that dialogue from the persona that you're with to a point of reference of business value, financial impacts, and how does this affect your organization, particularly, you know, 1 to 2 levels up. Because I can help make you a hero and help drive business value and financial impact to not just to you, but to the people that you serve in this organization. Then you build champions when you have that. But you can't go in there and just sort of like do that seat of the pants. You need a plan.
Yeah. And for our listeners that are sitting back in their chairs going, yeah, I do that, let me give you 2 more stats from that same Forrester study. One of them was only 15% of salespeople, 2 of these high-level executives, actually find value in those. I mean, I try to push myself. Was I in the 85% bucket where they didn't value this meeting, or was I in the 15% bucket? And to get in that 15% bucket, you know, my big thing is, you know, back to the how, do your homework. In fact, there's these things out there called like the Google machine and these things that everybody's been yapping about called AI. And I think it's easier than ever to get information about the industry, the market, you know, people at different levels and what their key cares are than ever before. You don't have to go to a library and open a book. Some people may not even know what that means. You can literally in minutes have a plethora of information right at your fingertips. Any other ideas on how you see the increased use of AI really helping buyers today?
Yeah, well, to your point, you know, just like the buyer can do a ton of research on, you know, vendors, we can do a ton of research on the buyer. And I think I'm beginning to use AI more and more. And I think jury's still out in terms of where and when it's the most successful. The thing that I've seen work and then fall short, I'll give you an example. I'm a big fan of listening to the recordings of publicly traded companies' earnings calls. I think there's a ton of information. Once you get past the first 20 minutes, which are all the prepared remarks from the CEO and the CFO in terms of, you know, earnings per share and the various financial metrics that they care about, then you get into this conversation between the analysts asking very specific pointed questions. I've loaded those into ChatGPT and gotten summaries. And the summaries are interesting, although what it reveals to me is actually something I think is also present in conversations, which it misses nuances. It misses the reading between the lines of what the analyst is asking and why they're asking. They're asking very specific questions that are trying to reveal strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So you have to understand sort of this, the underlying motivation. AI is not there yet with understanding that level of nuance. It's great to summarize things. I would never use it to write an email because I think it lacks a lot of things like understanding and empathy. It becomes very, listen, it's robotics, right? It's a, you know, it's going to sound robotic because it kind of is robotic, right? People buy from people they trust. And trust is a matter of listening, understanding, having empathy, and being someone that someone's willing to put their trust and put a stake in you to deliver the right outcomes. Just, you know, covering it like at the basic level isn't a trust-building exercise. So I think I use it, but I use it sparingly.
I always tell people to listen to the analyst call. Don't read the transcript. And the reason I go that extra mile is because when that analyst does ask that question, you'll notice that extra second or two delay in response. You'll notice the fumbling through words to address it. And you're like, ah, I'm onto a hot one. They're picking on a hot bullet point that's really affecting this account. So, I mean, that's a little nuance, but it's going that extra mile. When you'll hear it, you won't see it in a transcript, right? In a transcript, you see the answer.
It's also some of you hearing what is said, but what's not said. I'll give you an example. I was just listening to an earnings call the other day, and the analysts were, you know, asking the CRO certain questions. And he kept going back to, and we feel pretty good about that, right? Like, to me, that was a non-answer. Like, there was no statistical, you know, empirical evidence to support, you know, the fact that they think they're going to hit the new guidance. You know, he just kept going back to like, yeah, and we, you know, we feel pretty good about that. The next day, the stock dropped like 10%. And they actually hit their number. They guided sort of differently than the analysts were hoping for, but it was all in line with what they'd been saying. But I kind of think it was a fact that like they just did not manage the dialogue that was going on there. And I kind of attribute it maybe more so than I should, but there were nuances to the conversation that just did not set well with the analysts. And as a result, that stock took a 10% hit the very next day, which is interesting. So yeah, to your point, the transcript is just one dimension. I like the transcripts because I can go back and cross-reference and highlight things in the way I do to organize my thoughts when I circle back with a client. AI is not going to do a very good job of reading into what wasn't said. We can, because human beings have a different level of understanding.
Well, Greg, I could talk to you forever. I got one more question for you, and that is our acceleration insights. What's that one piece of advice, be it business or personal, that you would share with our listeners that would help them be as successful as you are?
This sort of came to me years ago. I was a big fan of all the, you know, self-help, personal growth kinds of studies and books and things like the Tony Robbins stuff and all that. And they were all very specific on, you know, set your goals and measure it and hold yourself and all those kinds of, you know, things, right? And the thing that those things are good, but those things are also very me oriented. It occurred to me some time ago that while I'm doing that in my best interest, it's all focused on me. I need to shift this focus. I need to be less concerned about my success, more concerned about my customer success. I would just say, go into your discussions, go into your workday and think about that. When you start shifting your energy and your emphasis on, am I going to close this deal? Am I going to make my number? Am I going to make the kind of money? To, am I going to make my customer successful? There's a big shift that happened to me. I remember it very vividly. So I say, stop selling, you know, start solving. It would be my takeaway from that.
All right, Greg, if our listeners want to get to know you a little bit better or get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
So LinkedIn, of course, I'm very active in LinkedIn. I've done a lot of posts, a lot of polls, et cetera. Greg Brown, you know, with Value Selling Associates, should get the job done there. Be glad to connect with y'all.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you more for your time. I really appreciate you spending the time with me today. I always love our conversations. And folks, that ends it for our episode. Please check us out at www.b2brevexec.com. Share the episode with your friends, your family, your coworkers. You can also find us and subscribe to us on YouTube, Spotify, Google. And if you do listen to us on iTunes, you can actually give us a 5-star rating, which we would greatly appreciate. I'm Carlos Noche, and I wish you nothing but the best success.
You've been listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.